And we are live, folks. Welcome to episode 3,832 of the Survival Podcast. It's Monday, and we're going to do something we often do on Mondays, but we don't do every Monday, and that is kind of a news day. We're going to look around at some of the things that are going on, some of the big stories, and some of the ones you may not have heard of unless you specifically monitor the niche they're in or something like that. I wouldn't say any of these are like hidden under the cover stories or anything, but the news is dominated by, let's say, 2/3 of what we're going to talk about today. And the other, the news is dominated by about 1/3 of what we're going to talk about today. The other 2/3 are things maybe you haven't really heard much about in the past few days, even though you probably should have. Number one, we're going to talk today about Trump and his new madman philosophy. Okay, you want to block the straight? We'll block the straight. Obviously, I have to come at this as an analyst, not with my opinions on like non-interference and non-aggression. I have to just look at this as an analyst and do something that, most of the people in media are incapable of, and that is to, you know, follow the words of Albert Einstein. It is the mark of an intelligent mind that a mind can entertain a thing without necessarily agreeing with it. Because the way this is being attacked by the left and all the special people is that there is no, it just doesn't make any sense. It actually, from a strategy standpoint, it doesn't even mean the strategy's right, but it makes sense. There's a strategy there. Actually a pretty militarily sound strategy if you can make it work. Right. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the idea of a non-proliferation treaty with China for nukes, like we had with the Soviet Union in the, you know, the 80s and the, whatever, with Reagan and Gorbachev, and no, yes. What do you mean, no, yes? Well, the model, yes. The problem, not nuclear weapons. Artificial intelligence. There's a recent article that came out, pretty fascinating. It's an opinion article. It's a guy that went to China, and this is what he basically said. We can't stop China from building powerful AI. Here's what we can do. And this is one of those stories that goes into the stuff that you're not really hearing about on the news. And when the news talks about AI, the people, the midget brain people talking about it who know nothing about AI on themselves, right? These are like the people that were telling you what the internet was while they couldn't figure out what the @ sign in an email was at the same time. The way we've been trying to prevent China from surpassing us in the world of AI is completely ineffectual. And it involves a restriction on physical hardware, which means nothing as to how many workarounds there are for it. And so the idea is that since they're going to do their thing and we're going to do our thing, and since we were all wrong about something called superintelligence, maybe we should make a deal. And then, well, if we do, could we enforce it? Can they enforce it? Like what? And then what's the larger message in that? And I'll talk about that today. Oh, by the way, Kraken is now a bank. Well, sort of. And yes, they are, but not in the way that, let's say, Chase is, right? JP Morgan Chase is a bank. Kraken's sort of a bank. They have access now to FedNow into the Federal Reserve, but they did it under a Wyoming bank charter thing that requires full reserves because they're not doing it so they can lend money, at least not the way that banks lend money with a fractional reserve system. So it's a full reserve bank on a 1-year trial, but this might be the biggest Bitcoin story that's not being talked about, even among a lot of Bitcoiners. And of course, the hardcore Bitcoiners, they have another big win on their hands, so they're unhappy and miserable and shrieking and screaming about selling your Bitcoin to BlackRock or whatever the fuck else is wrong with them now, because they don't understand if a thing is useful, it will have many uses, not just the one that you think is the most important use of it. So we'll talk about that. The world is also now being forced to buy U.S. oil. Yep. Even before Orange Man said, okay, you want to close the strait, we'll close the strait. There's an operation choke point that's not about crypto now. There's an operation choke point. And this will tie back into the madman Orange Man strategy of blocking the strait. But if you can't get your oil from where you usually get it from and somebody else has it, you got to go there. Well, that somebody else is now us. Given that we have basically taken control of all the oil coming out of Venezuela, and if you go to Canada, you might as well come here. We have better refinery, more capacity, et cetera, of actual oil you can use when you take it home. And so people are coming to the United States now. There are ships from all over the world heading here to fill up with U.S. crude. And we have better quality oil than Canada. A lot of countries that now need oil to refine themselves can refine our oil, but they can't refine Canadian tar sands oil. So again, you come to the United States because you can't get it from Iran or other oil producing countries that rely on the Strait of Hormuz to get their oil out. So what does that mean long term, though? Is this a sea change in U.S. oil policy? I don't think so. But it might have some short-term impacts to become long-term results. So we'll talk about that. Then long-term Bitcoin buyers, and I'm talking big money Bitcoin buyers, people that are stacking it in their organization as a capital reserve, people that are putting it in their retirement accounts, et cetera, they are stacking nonstop right through a bear market, which has never happened before. We've never had large holders stacking heavily and growing exponentially in the middle of the bear market of a cycle. And that could be because the cycle's dead. But we're going to talk about two things on that. And this relates to the earlier thing about Kraken becoming a bank. But we're going to talk a little bit about the ETF holdings again. It's just a key indicator you need to be looking at to understand what's really going on. And then Michael Saylor and Strategy. They're on track by September to be holding 1 million Bitcoin. That is 1/21st of all Bitcoin that ever will exist ever in all eternity. And those are two huge signals when we look at those two together, and then we add in things like what's going on with Kraken. Even though it's temporary, it's a temporary government policy. We know how those usually work out. And then I want to talk about some things that are more philosophical from my viewpoint. One is with AI. What we're really looking at with AI is automation. I don't know if you've ever really thought about that way, but we've had various forms of automation impact the workplace forever. You know, if you go back to, like, I have an uncle named Bobby on my mom's side of the family. He worked for GM. And back when I was a kid and he worked on an assembly plant in GM, the equipment was a little nicer and newer and all, but it wasn't much different than working on one for Henry Ford, right? Like, you know, the car comes forward, you bolt the piece on, like a man bolt. And now there's robots that do that. That was one form of automation. When I used to sell computer hardware, we sold a lot into the carrier space, but we also sold a lot into the industrial automation space where various processes on a factory floor can be automated. AI is the latest in the automation wave that goes back, again, 100 plus years. So what does it lead to? It leads to a greater divide in what I call the artisan versus automation bifurcation, right? That's where we're splitting. It's a divide. And each side ends up with its own form of a premium. And if that doesn't make sense, it will when we talk about it. And last, we just sent a giant rocket into outer space. And if you're one of the people that's going to tell me the Earth is flat, no, we didn't, the space program's fake, you might as well just throw in and wrestling's real, okay? I don't have time for you. We just sent a giant rocket into space with a manned capsule that went further than any human being has ever traveled from Earth in space before, because it went further behind the moon when it came back. It was an 8 or 9 day mission. It was an incredible feat of engineering, and nobody cares. Nobody cares. It went so well that we expect to accelerate the program and have men on the moon again by 2028, and no one cares. What does that say? What does that say? That no one cares about something like that anymore? Is it a symptom of microwave society? Is it just, but they didn't land on the moon, so no one cares? Why? And when I say no one cares, I mean, I looked for coverage of it, and unless you looked really hard, most of the time they were in space, there was nothing, nothing said. And it barely made a dent in the ratings when the splashdown aired on TV. What does that say? we'll talk about that from a philosophical point. Joss says it says we have bigger problems. Does it? Is that what it says? I'm not sure that it does. I'm not sure that it does because, well, we'll save it till I get to there. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is, who is it? It is Above Phone. That's right. You can rise above with the most privacy-focused laptops, tablets, laptops, tablets, and phones that you can possibly find anywhere. You should check out Above Phone. They've been a long-term sponsor of the Survival Podcast going back about 5 years now. I have an Above Phone and I have an Above Book. I love both of them. They provide me a lot more privacy. And when you get involved with Above Phone and you're like, but this is a new thing, I'm not really sure how to handle it, you get real support. You get 45-minute conference call with a support engineer, live email and chat support, articles and video courses, and more to help you onboard to your new advice. And it's more than you need. It's not that different. It's not that hard. It's really easy to use. The Above Book in particular, when I got my Above Book, it showed up and it had preloaded a whole bunch of videos on it that walked me through everything that I needed to know about using this new computer, which really wasn't that complicated at all to begin with. But all the little things are just a little bit different or look a little different or what have you. Walk me through every bit of it. Plus, if you have any questions, again, you got live support by chat and you get a 45-minute onboarding walkthrough with an Above Phone expert. And if you're an MSB member, you get $75 off any phone at abovephone.com. Next up today, a brand new sponsor. We don't say that around here often, and I'm actually very proud of that. Because it's not that I can't sell the spots, is that nobody leaves. I've got sponsors that have been with us for more than 16 years now. That's how crazy loyal our sponsors are to you guys. So when a new spot opens up, I want to make sure we bring you something of new value, something that maybe you didn't know about. And so when the Case Place reached out to me, I'm like, this is perfect. This is the stuff that you would, order normally from brands like Pelican, Hardig, SKB, and others like that. These are the most expensive rugged cases, the stuff that military and law enforcement and very high-end professionals that need to protect gear like photographers and people that do AV work out in the field rely on this type of casing because it's so high quality. What if I told you, Neo, you can get them for 50% to 80% off retail, like brand. Some of it is brand new from Overstock. Some of it has been, used and what have you, but it's all in like new condition. Check it out. These guys have almost 3,000 reviews on eBay, 95% positive feedback, super high star rating. And again, the gear that sells itself, the stuff that you would buy anyway, at more than half off the price, plus an additional discount for members. Yeah, I signed them up right away as not only an MSB supporter, but I was also willing to give them the spot that I had open for a new sponsor on the show. So now let's talk about this whole thing that's going on with Trump and Iran. And this was announced last week, and then with much consternation and people screaming and yelling at each other on social media about how stupid they were, the assertion made that Trump has no plan. Once again, no plan. It's Taco Trump, no plan Trump, and he's an idiot, and that nothing good can come from this, and there's no strategy behind it. I'm going to have to explain again to the special people out there. I am opposed to intervention unless it's absolutely required for national defense. I do not believe that it was necessary for us to be involved in this conflict at all. And I want you to think about that reality as I go forward, because I'm going to say things about this choice that seem to support it. It doesn't mean that I support it. I am coming at this from, is there a clear-cut military strategy with an agenda here that might be effective? So before you even examine this, you have to ask the question of what don't you know? What don't you know? What might actually make this more effective than it would even appear on the surface if you knew some other things that were going on diplomatically? So here's the thing you probably don't know, because certainly nobody on the TV wants to tell you this. China has been in negotiations with Iran saying, oh, you guys might want to cut a deal. And if you keep making this position worse for us, we may actually have to reconsider our relationship with you. Yeah, China's kind of pissed about this, and they're pissed at us. But they also don't really care about Iran, other than they like Iran being a thorn in our side. All they see out of Iran is an economic partnership that benefits them. And China is very cutthroat when it comes to business. They're very good at it, too. And Iran has become a source of cheap oil. A source of cheap oil that, since we shut down what was going on in Venezuela, and we have basically co-opted that oil. And again, I'm not saying we should or shouldn't. We just did. They're really pinched now. And it's more important to them that they have oil to run their country than what they think the U.S. and Iran should do. It just flat out is. It's an economic business decision, right? It's, we have to run the country. We have almost like 1.5 billion people here. The shit that has to run. We can't make enough energy ourselves. We need it from somewhere, and we've been getting it from over here. They don't just buy from Iran, though. They buy from other people in the Middle East who we get along with, who also can't get their oil through the strait. So the Iranians have been getting some tankers through, primarily Chinese flagged, through, and charging a toll for it and saying, hey, we'll let you through and we'll just let you pass. And you just have to pay us. And it's like $2 million a tanker or something like that is a toll that you're charging. There's some special people out there says, why can't Iran charge a toll for going through their strait? They've been so nice in letting everybody. Well, first of all, it's an international agreement that basically freedom of navigation exists through the strait. Second of all, international waters are 12 miles. And third of all, when you look at that and you see that Oman, at the closest point that pinches the strait, is 24 miles away from Iran, well, that's split in half, right? And both sides have equal legitimate claims to that area out to that 12 nautical miles from an international water standpoint. And then the most important part is, did you know? I bet you didn't, because no one would tell you this. The vast majority of ships that pass through the Strait of Hormuz never enter Iranian international waters. They stay on the Oman side of things, maybe by a mile, but on the Oman side. And they don't do it because Iran in of itself sucks. It's because it's an easier area to transit through. It's better maintained. It's just an easier way to pass through. So what Iran right now is actually doing when they block the strait is they're saying no ships can pass through our waters or Oman's international waters. So you have to know all that before you can judge what's going on here. The next thing is, well, the U.S. Navy has enough problems already. They have to block all these ships. No, they don't have to block hardly any ships at all. It's only a few. See, all the other ships, the U.S. government has done nothing to prevent them from going through. And Iran has not done much other than say, if you try, we will use our military assets to set your ship on fire. And therefore, the insurance companies are more at this than anything else. So the insurance companies are like, yeah, about that policy you had in case something happened to your ship. Yeah, we're not going to do that anymore until this is over. So the ship is uninsured. So the ship doesn't want to take on the liability without insurance that it could be attacked, damaged, be a total loss. So all those ships are just sitting there waiting. So it's only the handful being allowed to trickle through by Tehran that have been getting through. So they're the only ones that are being stopped by the United States Navy now. If China was already telling Iran, look, maybe you need to cut a deal, because if we don't have you for this need, then we don't really need you. Well, then maybe that pressure ramps up. And maybe if China is already in a pinch point, not just from the amount of oil they can get, but how much they have to pay for it. And now they have to pay the United States to get it. Maybe that pressure ramps up even more. Maybe more and more countries who are sort of kind of on Iran's side go, look, we can't afford this. We can't deal with your shit anymore. And that puts more pressure on them. Additionally, You need to know something about the military makeup. See, and here's somebody that can't think. They can't think. Operation APAC Fury. Okay, yes, I accept that Israel's involved with that. It has nothing to do with my fucking analysis because it is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain an idea without agreeing with it. You should try it. It might help you think more clearly. All right. So anyway, the Iranian military is not just the Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC. It is the IRGC and the Iranian National Army. And there's a name for it that's escaping me right now. I can't think of what the name is. It's a fairly short name, single word, that is the name of this national army that has been in existence for longer than the current government, longer than the Shah's government. It goes back hundreds of years. They're more like as in similar, the United States Army than the IRGC, in that you probably know somebody you grew up and went to school with who's in the Army. They like lived in your neighborhood or something like that. And you guys get along to this day. And that kind of gives you some sense of at least some comfort, because you know all the people in that military branch of the United States Army kind of are blue collar guys from the block, right? And they have their allegiance more to the country than to the government, if that makes sense. They're more about defending the homeland than defending the bureaucracy. The IRGC exists to defend the Iranian government, not the Iranian homeland. They're very disparaging groups. The IRGC is controlled with money. They are paid better. That's it. The Artesh, right? That's the Iranian National Army, the Artesh. So the IRGC is paid about twice as much for an equivalent rank, if you look at it that way, as the Artesh. They do very well for themselves, even kind of a low-level member, compared to an average blue-collar worker. They're all paid with money from the Iranian mullahs, the government, the top level. They exist to protect the mullahs, right? And that's their purpose. That's why they're used to put down rebellion in the streets and things like that. When the Artesh has been sent out is when they're sent out to do something like that, they like, yeah, sure, we'll go out and kill all the civilians. And they just like, they go like go guard infrastructure and pretend to go along, but they don't go out and lay waste to people like the Revolutionary Guard does. So you've got that dynamic at play. But what keeps the Revolutionary Guard loyal is the paycheck. If you pinch off the money, if you cause hyperinflation of the Iranian currency, if they can't charge Bitcoin for a tanker going through in millions of dollars per ship and keep the machine running that way, and now they can't get material in it because China's like, we're going to send Iran a whole bunch more air defense systems. First of all, we blew up all your old air defense systems, so I hope for your sake they work better. But how are you going to get them there? You don't think we can see that shit? You don't bring that shit in like in a submarine, right? Like, you have to get that shit there. You don't think we can blow that shit up before they ever install it? So you start pinching off their ability to get stuff and do stuff and move stuff and pay their people. Then your strategy is to create a massive conflict internally and turn the National Army against the Republican Guard and try to create an internal coup. Is that going to happen? I'm not saying it's going to happen. Not at all. I'm not predicting it. What I am telling you is the concept of creating, if saying you want a choke point, okay, let's see who can choke who harder. We're going to sit over here, sell the rest of the world our oil, and choke off your ability to sell Jack Diddley shit. And we're going to turn your allies against you because they only have you as an ally because of what you can do for them economically, and now you can't do that. I mean, I want you to think about it from a standpoint of culture, right? I'm not saying the Chinese are nice guys or anything, but the Chinese have no tolerance for religion at all. Do you think that they are tightly aligned with an Islamic regime for ideological reasons? And the answer is no, they're not. So there's a strategy here. That's my only point today. There is a strategy to this. And from a military analysis standpoint, it's as good as any strategy that's been employed so far. And it does have a point, and it does have a pressure point to be applied against the enemy. And if you say that it doesn't, you're either like really low IQ or you're pretending not to understand because you don't want to. I'm sorry. I don't like it either, but it is what it is. I always say this and I always will. What you want means nothing. What is everything, right? The way things should be mean nothing. The way things are is how we have to base our life decisions on. And this is the way things are. Next up, I found this to be interesting. I found this to be really, really interesting. I was looking for news to talk about today, and this story popped up from the New York Times, and I have links to everything in the audio notes like I always do, which is if you're watching the video, there's a link right down in the video notes so you can go over to the audio side. If I'm live, it won't work yet. It'll have to be about a half hour after the live stream ends before the audio side only goes up. But the contention in this piece, the title is, why can't we can't stop China from building powerful AI? Here's what we can do. But the summation of this is, I went to China and from the author, and I examined what's actually happening in China, and we can't stop it. It's impossible. There's nothing we can do to alter China's course with AI. There's things China is actually concerned about that we have in common, and maybe we can work on that. But let's start off with why we can't stop it. Okay, so one of the things that we did is we have a lot of the hardware, the chipsets, et cetera, that are the cutting edge things that are necessary to run a super high-end AI data center. Let's leave it at that. And this is not little tiny pieces of equipment. This is big pieces of equipment, and you need a lot of them. So this isn't something you can smuggle into a briefcase and get on a plane and bring in. You're talking like cargo ships to bring enough in to build a data center. And China does not have, as for all their technology, the technological sophistication to build the equipment, the chipsets, et cetera, that are at that leading edge of what's going on here. So the Biden administration decided we need to slow down China's advance with AI. And their solution to that was, we won't allow exports of this equipment, including some equipment that we oversee the manufacturing of, that there maybe not be made domestically like Taiwan or something, and you won't sell it to them either. And so everybody agrees that's in the chain. We won't sell it to Iran. It's basically a type of a sanction, and you can't have the equipment. So of course, you know, there's plenty of other countries that can buy the equipment. Many of them Asian countries that are at least China friendly from an economic standpoint. So they built data centers in China. China's just buying space in the data centers. Yeah, right now, I mean, there's tons of sites. If you want to start spinning up your own AI project and you want to rent GPUs or even buy and co-locate GPUs without ever touching them, you can do that. There's plenty of hosting companies right now. GPU compute is now a line item that they offer. So the Chinese companies and the Chinese government, where they can't get enough equipment domestically, are simply co-loing with data centers in countries that we sell to who are also friendly with China. And that's been going on, and there's really no way to stop it. Additionally, China is going to figure out how to build this shit. Right. Like, you only have to get your hands on a few of these things to kind of remember. And China's really good at it. So sooner or later, they're not even going to need to do that anymore. So what this author surmises, and again, you can read the piece for yourself if you want, but that we should work with China and come to some sort of an agreement as to what we all won't do, or at what speed this stuff will deploy. And you'd think that that would be like, yeah, sure, because China's going to like really go along with it. Well, I think yes and no. I think at the government level, from a military strategist viewpoint, both sides are going to do whatever they're going to do, and nothing's going to stop it. However, on a broader scope, the Chinese government is getting just as nervous as anybody else with some of the things that have happened recently, like the open claw issue and, oh, holy shit, this thing's running around doing things it's not supposed to do. And it's literally a security threat everywhere that it is. So let's roll that back a little bit. Like, that's an eye opener because China's moved much quicker with this than we have. We got out ahead in the beginning, but from a standpoint of who's accelerating the fastest right now, we're still ahead, but China's accelerating quicker than we are. And this all comes down to an incredibly big whoopsie that everybody thought about AI before we had what we think of today as AI. There was this belief in like this super intelligence, this generative intelligence, and it was going to work like this. Once we cross the threshold that we crossed in about 2022 to 2023 with you know, LLMs like ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, et cetera, Grok, Meta, all of it, that it would become something that could improve itself, truly self-learning, instead of you keep adding data and new instructions so it can do more, that it would very quickly move to a point where it itself took on sort of a life of its own, not necessarily artificial general intelligence where it's truly sentient, but that you could basically command it to get better and it would. It doesn't work that way. Oops. So the whole view was in the United States, since we knew we were leading the Europeans, the Chinese, Russia, everybody, since we're going to get there first, we've got it. Because once we get there and our system is capable of self-improvement, there's no way they'll catch up to us because we'll get to that point first. And from there, it's a forever trail. It doesn't work that way. ChatGPT will not get any better than it is right now this second, just because you and a lot of other people use it. It takes action on the back end to improve its capabilities by humans that work for OpenAI. And the same thing is true of Grok, and the same thing is true of Gemini. So this idea that the machine itself would become a self-improving machine, we're not even close. We thought we were until it doesn't do it. Shit. So that's where we are now. So now we're sitting at a point where you have competing global powers trying to make sure the other one doesn't run away too fast. And at the same time, all of them kind of looking at it more like a biological than an electronical agency, right? So what I mean by that is there is a fear, a well-placed fear, that it's not that, hey, you're going to use an LLM like GPT or Gemini or Grok, and it's going to take over your computer. But these specific advanced cutting-edge agents that we start letting loose may start to do some things we really don't want them to do, like, I don't know, hack every bank account, for a given series of numbers or something like that. Because that was one of the open claw fears, that, like, this thing is a danger. Like, it has no moat, nothing to keep it in, and it could start running wild and causing problems. So maybe that can, but I have a totally different viewpoint of what this really means. You can't stop it. They can make any treaty they want. It doesn't matter. 10 guys that set up a data center in a garage can keep building this and will. It's almost like, because it's not the same as, right? But it's almost like open sourcing nuclear warhead development, to where everything you need to know, not just the theory, but everything you need to know about how to build a nuclear weapon is in an open source file that anybody can use, modify, add to, enhance. And it's not as bad because it's not a nuclear bomb that can end all life on Earth, but it sure as hell can cause a lot of problems. But what are you going to do about it? And the answer is you're not. All of this is a deception. All of this is a belief that you can control something that cannot be controlled. It's the same belief the United States government had a plan to take over email and charge people to use it at one time. I shit you not. And they believed that unless they did that, that no one would really adopt email because they wouldn't have an assurance from the state that it could. That sounds like Bitcoin in dollars. Anyway, but that was her. So there's a track record of these people believing they can do things that they can't do. They believe they can stop something by passing a law. That hasn't worked out really well for anybody or any place that they've tried to enact that. Like, oh, I don't know, drugs. Right. Or, you know, places where they've banned guns, like then all the criminals have guns. Like, you can't stop certain things. And I think this actually shows us where AI is going. And I think it's to a place that nobody realizes. I think that right now everybody believes the long-term play of AI is to get as many users as you can plugged into your machine, have everything centralized and controlled. So you control them all like nodes. And that way you can surveil them, steal their data, monitor their activities, and improve the effect of your own machine by using them as the guinea pig. That's the viewpoint. And I don't think long-term that's very sustainable. And so what is the biggest contention right now about AI outside of the people that think it's a devil or a demon or it's the Terminator that takes over the traffic system and kills us all or puts us in pods like the Matrix? If you get rid of that clownery, what is the single biggest contentious thing that normal people are like, yeah, that could be a problem when it comes to AI? And the answer is simple. Energy use, i.e. data centers. So these giant data centers use all this energy in one location. They centralize that energy use. They centralize that heat production. They need more energy for cooling, et cetera. I think that you're going to see, and the best term I have for it is a self-custody version of AI rolled out. And giant companies are already doing this in conjunction with companies like Google and OpenAI. It uses what I call a fish trap model. So if you think of a basic fish trap, like you can buy on Amazon for $20, it's basically a cage and it's got funnels that go into the center. And the funnels narrow down to a relatively small hole so that the fish can swim in easily, but it's hard to get out. And then we put bait into that trap. And then when a fish wants that bait, it kind of looks around the trap and eventually it goes in there. And it's a one-way path, hopefully, anyway. And the better the trap, the more that's the case. The fish can get in, but the fish can't get out. What does that have to do with self-custody and AI? So what large companies are doing already, and you can understand why they would at a macro level, if you think about like a drug company. So back when I sold network equipment and testing equipment and all, I got to go into some pretty cool data centers, including I went into a data center in Quantico for the FBI. I also went in New Jersey into a data center for Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceuticals. I'm not going to say that the Johnson & Johnson data center was more secure than the FBI database or the FBI data center, but it was as secure. Like, you have to put your phone in a thing, and then they wand you, and there's all types of layered security, and like you get into this one space, and then you're kind of checked out and have certain things explained to you. Then you go to a secondary space and then it happens again. And then you get into the data center. Why? What's the IPR of a drug patent worth? Especially one that's not all the way there yet. A lot of money. What is the customer database? What is all that data worth inside Johnson & Johnson or any pharmaceutical company, Pfizer or what have you? A lot of money. Let's just leave it at that. A lot of money. And so there's a very big need for security. So if you have users working on projects using AI, and it's a cloud-based AI like ChatGPT, even if they say, trust me, bro, we're not sharing your data, you're like, yeah, we even if you mean well, even if you're completely honest, we can't trust that you have the skill set necessary. So what these – but at the same time, the organization's like, we need it. If we don't use it and our competitor does, they're going to bash our skull in. So what they're doing is they're setting up this fish trap model where they're able to pull new data in, but they're running their own compute using assistance from the larger company or the AI company, the OpenAI, or using Google or whomever to basically create this environment. so that when their machine, their compute needs data that's current, happened yesterday, it can access that information and bring it in. It's like the Roche Motel, right? Or Black Flag, right? Roaches check in, but they don't check out. Like the data comes in, but nothing proprietary goes back out. That's the model they're building for giant companies. Everything they build for giant companies, eventually they sell to you. And it solves a big problem if the way you would run your own AI is to provide your own computational speed capability. And now you're buying a $2,000 computer that right now would probably cost you $10,000. But if we're making them in that number for this use, economy of scale takes over. And some of the first ones that we have that will be tailor-made for, because you can do this all right, but tailor-made for this, they're probably going to run $1,000 to $2,000. Oh, nobody will do it. Yeah, they will. And eventually they'll push it and they'll make it cheaper and cheaper for you to do it because you're offloading your biggest expense, compute, which is energy. So it's like moving the Bitcoin miner out of the centralized facility. They will also probably have co-located compute. So now they have the data center, but you pay for your own part of the compute in it. And they'll probably be eventually open source things that allow users to provide compute in a semi-autonomous way, meaning that your excess computing capacity will be shareable in a network of your own choosing to federate with. These are all the things I get out of this story that the story has nothing to do with. Once you accept you can't stop it, and you accept that people are going to use it, and you accept that people are going to develop it, and you accept that it does not take a state-level actor to do something new with this technology, that really there are tons of people that have enough intelligence that once they grab the base code that's available, they can modify at will, and you can't prevent it, then you have to start saying, what does the architecture look like that makes the most sense for the people who have the opportunity to make the most money? And I think self-hosted AI that is backed up by updates in without your data going out, where you're responsible for all or some of your compute power, that makes the most sense for the big corporations. And I know there's resistance to that because, well, they're evil and they want all your data. Yeah, I understand that. But what they want more than your data is your money. And right now, a lot of the AI companies, that base level subscription that you pay for, that $15, $20 a month, whatever it is, they actually lose money on you, especially if you use a lot of compute. You get so many tokens or whatever, but when you really run the math, GPT, OpenAI's founder, said like a year into it, we're losing money on every paid subscriber we have right now. I think some of that's changed, but it's not like you pay $20 and they make 18, and it's never going to get there where we're at right now. But if you're paying $20 providing your own compute, and your own power, then they make 18 on your 20. Now you're back. Cause see, this business, basically software as a service type of business, this is traditionally an incredibly high margin business. When you write software that people pay to rent, it's like a money printer. Your cost of delivery is incredibly low. But when you have to, when you're like, ChatGPT, tell me about fill in the blank with some random bullshit. Even though 100 people made that same query today, it's a whole new set of GPU spinning somewhere, and it doesn't happen for free. And I think that's where this is all heading next. All right, moving on. Let's talk about a big story. I mean, a big, big story. And I'm really not sure why they have a picture of Trump with Powell at the Fed here when he was taking him to task for spending too much money. But the Federal Reserve officially approved Kraken Financial as the first digital asset bank with direct access to the United States payment system. This is a really unique situation that we're in here. And I want to unpack what it actually means versus what some of the special Bitcoiners are saying on X. What it really means is that Kraken can effectively act as your bank and your crypto exchange at the same time. And I want to break it down before we talk about what it means to institutional level clients to what it would mean to an average everyday person who you just hold Bitcoin or whatever crypto you hold, whatever shit coins you hold, I don't care. And at some point, you might actually need money that you don't have. And so now you have to go into your crypto vault and you have to sell some of it because whoever you're doing business with will not accept it. Okay. And so let's say you were buying a car and you're going to go heavy down payment and still have a payment program and you're buying a car for $40,000. You're putting $10,000 down. And so you decide, well, I'll sell $10,000 worth of crypto and I'll write a check for the down payment on the car. And your exchange is Coinbase. What does that look like from a logistics standpoint? Well, you first have to either put the crypto on Coinbase if you're self-custodying, or you already have it there. Either way, it has to be there. Then you have to sell it for cash. By the way, there's a fee for that. And then after it's converted to cash, and this will take 3 to 4 days to happen, 3 to 4 work days to happen, you have to then withdraw the cash to your bank, and then you can write a check for it. So let's say that I go in and I make the deal to buy this new car on Thursday, and I want to buy my car. And I realize, shit, I don't have enough cash in the bank. I need 10 grand. And let's say that I don't self-custody because I'm a dumbass, and the money's already there. So right at the car dealership, I can go in and say, sell $10,000 worth of shitcoin XYZ, $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, whatever. And that transaction will happen instantaneously, and Coinbase will rake me up the butt for fees to do so. And then I will say, I would like to withdraw it to my bank account, where once again, they will charge a fee. And then some portion of, so I have to then take out more, I have to sell more than I want to. I mean, I'm leaving the tax consequences out because you're probably selling a little bit more to cover the tax side of it, right? But let's just say it's 10 grand. And then I say, like, I want to withdraw this to my bank account, assuming I've already linked it and they've already approved it and they haven't told me I have to get it reapproved because they do that from time to time, which causes more friction. It will take maybe Monday, Tuesday next week before I can spend my money and buy the car. You can see where that is a issue. Okay. Right. You can see where that could be an issue. Now, think about it from a standpoint of a corporation, an operating company. Specifically, when you start looking at things like what Michael Saylor is doing and all, and you get into a level where you have someone doing more, not what he's doing now with strategy, but more in the beginning, we're just sweeping excess capital in. And you go to your board and you say, yeah, we want to start just like the most basic thing you could be doing, parking surplus capital in Bitcoin. And they go, okay, well, what's that look like? And you explain it. And they go, so what if we need the money? And you go, well, we just sell it and get the money out. It's liquid. And they go, explain what liquid means. And then you just say all that bullshit I just said at a higher level. But basically you're saying is our bank will have to receive the funds on this 3-day hold on this highly volatile asset. And banks traditionally have, in many instances, debanked people for their crypto usage. Your boards of directors are extremely conservative by nature. That is poison. I don't think we're doing that. I don't even think we should tie our bank account to that risk is too much. Well, now you just open up a new bank account with a bank. This has access to things like Fedwire. And now you can run your crypto initiative seamlessly. And you don't have to go from one institution to another burning time and money to do so. That's one of the biggest Bitcoin stories not being talked about. So, of course, the crypto bros, right, and the Nazi-level Bitcoiners are all mad. This is horrible. I mean, the whole point of Bitcoin and Satoshi was to completely bypass the Federal Reserve. Yes, and we did that so effectively, they have no choice but to play ball with us now, and you're blackpilling. What is wrong with you? Well, you don't understand. No, don't tell me the magic. I was there when it was written. Okay. I've been here since the beginning. I understand fully the argument you're making. I just understand how ridiculous it is. If I make something extremely useful, it is going to get used in many ways, not just the way the inventor came up with. Look at what is the greatest idea for an invention in the history of mankind? A lot of people think it's a light bulb. It was such a good idea. We made it the symbol for an idea. But in reality, it would be the wheel, wouldn't it? I mean, I could do it with a light bulb, but literally think about the wheel. What would we not have today if we didn't have a wheel? If no one had figured out, hey, a round thing spins and you can put it on an axle and you can move stuff with it. Because how many ways is the wheel used? It's on your car. It's on your lawnmower. It's on your wheelbarrow. It's used in that conventional wheel way, but we use it to make pottery. How many machines don't have any wheels on them, but have lots of wheels in them? A lot. A tremendous amount, right? What I mean is inside the machine, there's wheels. If you open up the hood of a car, you'll see a belt on the motor, depending on, it could be a serpentine single belt. Most older engines had two or three belts, you know, did things like spin your alternator to charge your battery and things like that and provide electricity to the vehicle beyond the battery, which its main purpose is just to start the vehicle, right? That's what its purpose is. And once it's running, you're taking the mechanical energy from the engine and converting it to the electrical needs the vehicle has to run things like spark plugs and headlights and a radio. It's not running off the battery or the battery would die. Yeah. You understand how wheels do all of that. So imagine the idea that you would make the case that I don't know why you're putting a wheel inside a machine. It's designed to move stuff. I don't know why you're putting a wheel on an axle and then another wheel on the other side and they're different sizes and moving it with your foot to spin clay, because that's not the purpose of a wheel. You see how stupid that would be to think that way. That's what I think the special Bitcoiners are doing, right? They have this idea that the only purpose of Bitcoin is to give the middle finger to central bankers and have money they can't touch. You can have money they can't touch that's yours, and they can still touch that form of money, and they can still use it and leverage it, and they can still offer services for it. And there's nothing you can do to stop that. Just like we just talked about AI, there's nothing the government can do to stop AI from being developed. Because if something can be done, somebody's going to do it. And so this is a huge win. And there are some other things going on. Like Morgan Stanley just dropped a very low-cost ETF. And I think it's something like 0.15 or 0.14 or 0.19 is the fees on it. So it's well under 1%, no matter if it's a half a point, it's still super cheap. So the trading fees are very low, and that makes it very, very attractive to investors. They told their investment managers, like their financial liars, basically the advised clients, we recommend up to 9% of a portfolio going to Bitcoin at this point. They didn't say do it. We said we recommend this. We're sanctioning this mindset up to 9%. And hey, it's, you know, Morgan Stanley brokerage. So use the mortgage. I mean, it's their ETF. Of course, they want to sell it. You got to sell a lot to make some money at under a point per trade. But you can make a lot of money with it. You can make a ton of money with it. And it's a very attractive model for people that want all of their investments consolidated in one place. That's another piece of the story. And it's all in the article that I have linked for you today. But I'm telling you, we are in a different place right now. And I'm gonna hold my thoughts on Bitcoin for just a minute while we talk about something else first. And that is the dynamic of the oil market. And I've tried to basically bridge with breaks in between these stories as they link together today for you. So Trump made an announcement that empty oil tankers are heading to the U.S. to load up with oil and gas. And if you hate Trump, you're the part. No, they're not. Yes, they are, for F's sake. This is all stuff that can. There's transponders. We can look up public shipping. We can see where they're going. They are coming. You know, if they weren't, there'd be definitive proof that they weren't coming. There'd be the countries that we say are coming would be like, no, we're not, right? So they're heading to the United States. This is the thing. The distance for most of these countries that are buying oil from us now that don't normally buy oil from us, because I'm going to tell you right now, this idea that we need anything to do with the Middle East for oil supply is nonsense. The U.S. is a net exporter of oil, meaning we send more oil out than we use. Okay? We only import right now about 9% of the oil that we use in this country, and it isn't because we need it. It's because having different grades of oil at a refinery allow for more flexibility to keep the refinery running at optimum levels. So we buy certain different grades of some things and certain different reserves of some things to create that environment where we can run our refineries at optimum all the time, you know, weather considering and stuff like that, depending on what goes on with, you know, hurricanes and shit. And so because of that, we have a lot more oil than we need, honestly. And when oil prices are high, that's the time you want to export and bring. You're taking a commodity that, you know, if you look at it from a pragmatic view, it's probably going to cost a lot less than 6 months, and you're exchanging it for cash now. You're selling high, and your customers buying high. And a lot of rigmarole is being made by this with the Orange Man's team of, look, see, they're all going to come to us and buy our oil, and we're going to make so much money. You're going to win so much, you're going to get tired of winning. This is where, you know, like, as an analyst, I'm not pro or anti anything. I'm analyzing the thing. Don't get your heart set on that. It'll happen, but it won't change anything in your life. That a U.S. oil company makes more money this year, it won't really matter to you much at all. It won't make the price of your house go down. It won't make you richer. It will make the country a little richer, but it's also going to be a short-term thing. Because sooner or later, this shit in the Middle East has to get untangled. It has to. And then those ships aren't going to come here. Because it's not just about getting oil. It's the cost of it. So it takes those ships, most of the ships that are leaving Iran and taking oil to another country as a customer, are traveling relative to coming to the United States quite a short distance. So it costs money to move a ship. I don't know if you know that or not, but it takes money to operate a ship and move it across an ocean. So they're not just paying more by the barrel, they're paying more in the total because it's costing more to transport the oil. So they don't want to keep buying it from us. So it's going to be an interesting thing to watch how this plays out. I see it as being a very short-term situational thing, but it also may allow the U.S. even greater leverage in some ways as well. All right, so with that, I want to move on to back to Bitcoin. And I want to talk about something that has literally never happened before in the Bitcoin market. And I think it's why a lot of people are saying that the four-year cycle, at least as it has been traditionally, is dead. In other words, if you go back to the prior cycle, Bitcoin ran up to about 69,000, and then it kind of teetered at the top, and it was in kind of the right space of the cycle. And then people like me, as it started to crumble back down a little bit and realized, like, it's not going to do a triple shoulder. Then it's double shoulder and it's done. And I'm analyzing the future. We're heading into the bear. And it was so predictable, because it wasn't because I was a genius. It was so predictable that I said the bottom of the market would be 14.4 at that point when Bitcoin was still trading in the 50s. And I don't remember exactly, but it was like $800. I got within $800 of the number. And when we hit the bottom, I said, there it is, buy all you can get. That's it. It went back up. I'm not a genius. It was math and timing and a repetitive cycle. And yes, it could have gone down more, but it didn't. And now it's showing all these technical indicators. And that means that we're heading out the other end of that cycle. Whereas this time, we topped out in the 120s and people are crying about 70,000. If you do the proportional math, it would have a long way to go. You would be looking at a bottom by the traditional pattern in around $28,000. I don't see that happening. Nobody else does either. The graph that's on your screen, if you're watching the video right now, is the most important indicator about investor sentiment on Bitcoin outside of the diehard retail hodlers and the retail chickens that you will ever see. This is built on a technology provider service called Dune, and it is the Bitcoin ETF holdings and inflows for all the Bitcoin ETF companies. I don't like ETFs. Shut up. I don't care. It doesn't matter. We're doing analyst work today, not your emotional freaking triage to make you feel good. This is how much money is being held in Bitcoin. Actually, it's really how many units of Bitcoin are being held inside ETFs. And the bull market that we're in right now, or I'm sorry, the bear market we're in right now began about mid-November. Let's find mid-November on the graph. Where is it? It's about right there. That is 11/18/2025. That was the last time there was a significant outflow of total Bitcoin held in ETFs. If you go back to the peak before it, it was up around October 9th. So from October 9th, there was a pretty good drawdown going from, what, 1.3 million down to 1.2 million, right? Actually, 1.33 down to 1.29. So it wasn't even that much, but it was enough to at least see on the graph that it went down. There is where your, you know, problems in the market showed up. There is where the price dropped. And it dropped significantly after that point, up and down like it does, bouncing around like a roller coaster. But look at the graph. The graph from that point forward, this is not about price. For those that can't see the graph and maybe visualize it, this is about total units of Bitcoin held in ETFs. It goes on an exponential upward run. And if you look at the macro of the map, of the graph from the very beginning, from the day that the ETFs were introduced, it is a constant flow up in units held. There are some correction points and some downturns where people did dump some of it. And I would say that was probably mostly day trader type folks running large macros in the trading cycle that had switched to using the ETF for trading because there's lower fees. And I said that from day one, traders will use it. But most of the people using these ETFs, these are long-term holders. A lot of this is institutional money. It's not Bill's 401k. Some of this is pension funds that up till now couldn't hold Bitcoin that are now stacking Bitcoin inside a pension fund at 2 to 3% of the pension fund's value. It's a very small piece for them, but when you have five or six of those companies doing it, it's a huge impact on a limited supply like Bitcoin. What this means is during the point in the market cycle that screams, we're going down, long-term holders are buying more. That is not how the bear markets have been big bears in the past. What's happened is only the hardcore hodlers have made it through this time. And all of the people that came in because they heard Elon Musk said it was good, or their neighbor told them to buy it, or their neighbor drove up in a Lambo and they said, how'd you get this? I bought Bitcoin in 2013. Whatever it was that made them buy, they either became members of the cult, and I say that in a positive way, I'm a member of the cult, right? Where they're like, I understand the long-term outlook here. I don't care what it does. It doesn't matter. I'm buying every day or every week or every month, and I don't give a shit. Those guys held. And all the newest class, about half of those people, the minute it went down 20%, freaked out and sold, which caused it to go down further, which caused more freaking out, more selling, and that's been that cycle. That four-year cycle is you get a halving, the new supply contracts, at the same time, excitement builds momentum in buying. Buying brings in new people. New people are chicken shits, and they think they're going to be rich overnight. They have unreasonable expectations. They buy through Robinhood or some shit like that. And then as soon as things look a little bit gray, I sold it because it was going to go to zero. The effect of those people has been massively mitigated. When people are stacking this at a 401k, when people, because do you do that with your 401k? Are you like, oh shit, my mid-cap stock ETF went down 10% this quarter. I better sell it before it goes to zero. You just look at money differently when it's in that form. And if you're a pension fund manager and you've been given an edict, keep 3% of our value in Bitcoin. Or every cycle that we buy in, 3% of our new buy-in for assets that we hold, make it Bitcoin. Then you just do it. That's what you're looking at. Oh, but we're not done yet. The chat of chads, man. Michael Saylor with Strategy. This is one thing I love about them. They actually publish a table that you can look up and see on their website that shows strategies, Bitcoin purchases. And they just updated it today on the 13th of April with purchase number 106, 13,927 Bitcoin. Not $13,000, not $13 million, 13,000 individual Bitcoin at $71,900 roughly. So they just bought a shitload more Bitcoin to the point where their total holdings is now 780,897 Bitcoin. The financial products that Saylor's put out, like Strive and Strike and things like that, that they're designed to maintain a par value and pay a dividend, have fluctuated from the par value over the last year, 0.01%. That is better than a stable coin. That is better than a U.S. dollar fund. And they've been able to pay out the promised dividends with no problems whatsoever in a bear market. And he has a stated goal by this fall. Strategy will hold 1 million Bitcoin, and they're reporting their Bitcoin yield to date on an ongoing basis, and that is the metric for success. Can we make our investors happy? Can we pay our dividends? And can we grow our Bitcoin yield? If we can do that, we're golden. That's their viewpoint. If they can do that now, then they don't have any problems at all when Bitcoin goes on a tear again. And for those that think it's a Ponzi scheme, like the people that hate everything that isn't your version of what it's supposed to be, Bitcoin could go to $32,000 for 30 years and their investment vehicles wouldn't move. They would be able to do exactly what they're doing now for 30 plus years. That's math, and that's published too. One more time. If you've waited till now, all you've done is keep yourself from an economic success you could have had. You do what you want with that information. I think that everybody should be making Bitcoin part of their long-term investment strategy. And if you're not, I think you're missing the boat. And I'm just going to tell you, if you have a question, make sure you put the word question all caps. I got that one there, and I think I know what it means, but you might want to, refine that a little bit. I'm not sure what you're asking there, but I've only got a few questions so far. But if you want to ask me a question in the live feed, put the word question or comment in all caps, and I will try to get you an answer toward the end if I see it. So right now I've got about 4 starred for that. All right, so let's move on to something though. Let's go back to AI, but a different way of looking at it. Let's not call it AI. Let's call it what it is in the macro, the latest iteration of automation. We've been dealing with automation since the Industrial Revolution. The first factories ran on steam engines or they ran on hydropower. And because of that, the heaviest equipment had to be as close as possible to power generation as possible. So we automated factories in the beginning with your task will be easier because you have a machine to press something or bend something that normally we would have to do with human labor. But we couldn't optimize the factory completely because we had to locate the equipment based on the power distribution dynamic. Then electricity came. That allowed us to move energy anywhere at the speed of light and do so in an incredibly efficient distributed way, non-centralized. And because of that, we were able to start optimizing factories from a standpoint of this piece of equipment goes in this place in the factory because it makes the most sense. That sped up automation. as we moved into, you know, post-World War II, and we're moving pretty fast, we're jumping here because I don't want to go through everything in this, but we started to get some of the most basic robotics added to assemblages and factories and things like that. And all of a sudden, a robot could take the tire and put it on the car and spin the nuts on and do a better job, exact torque specifications. And this is going back, you know, 1960s and 70s, that we already had that. And this just continued. The safety inspector, all of a sudden, instead of like 10 of those guys running around and checking everything, you had shift work, three guys, each working a shift in a 24/7 factory that mostly they sat behind a screen and watched pressure sensors instead of going out and taking man. Like, there, we undervalue how many things that not so long ago had to be done with a manual process that is now automated. And that has continued. And it's in all things, guns, a gunsmith, that made guns, not just that did a little bit of work for you back in the day. You know, they might engrave a shotgun and they pretty much slept with the damn thing. And if they got inspired in the middle of the night, they woke up and chiseled a little bit of the bird dog and the pheasant and whatever in the scene, and everything was handmade. It was truly an artisan product. And, you know, with stamping and all types of machinery, we can make guns for a fraction of the cost relative to currency now than we used to. And, you know, machine pressed guns are not new either, but we have gotten to better quality guns with that automation process. But yet somebody will still pay for basically an AR they could have done themselves that was built with a lot of automated processes, but had things done to it by a qualified gunsmith or an expert or whatever, and customized after the fact. They change out the trigger, they put this accessory on it, they, you know, took it apart and made it run like butter or what have you. And so we still had this kind of automation and artisan approach. And if you think about it, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Cars are largely built by artisans, but when you want something really custom done to your car and you go to a custom shop, it's human that does the work. And if you go to a restaurant that is like a mid-tier, lower-level restaurant, you're eating basically food that was delivered in a Cisco truck that was heated up. And if you go into a really nice establishment, it's a chef-curated meal that was, you know, executed flawlessly by a line of cooks in the back who take extreme pride in what they do. One is a mass production automated process with some humans involved, and the other is a fully artisan delivered thing. And as we add AI to this, what I see is a larger bifurcation of that divide. And the artisan's use case is going to have to be, but you can't get this from an automated process. A knife maker would be a perfect example. There's places they just stamp out knives. Boom, 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 boom. They're sharp. They work. They function. They're made out of good steel. There's nothing wrong with them. From a functional standpoint, they're probably as good or so close to as good as a custom-made knife that from a, you know, can you skin a deer with it? It doesn't even matter. But somebody's still going to pay $500, $600, $700, $800 for that custom knife because they want that level of care and craftsmanship, fit, form, and finish, and look in that product. So the question for the artisan is, how do you maintain the artisan status and still integrate AI automation into what you do? Because the expert knife maker still has to market the knife. And AI is really good at marketing. That is the divide that we have been in for a long time. But the bifurcation and the splitting is accelerating. And it's something that if you think, and I brought this up, not just because some of you are, you know, expert knife makers, or you make custom woodwork, or you do custom stonework, or something very high trade value like that, but many of you have jobs that you think this doesn't apply to you. I'm a plumber. This doesn't apply to me. Why not? Well, Elon's robot won't be going to anybody's house to unclog their shitter anytime soon. Okay, I agree. But you don't think your company's going to use AI and scheduling, marketing, et cetera? Oh, and if AI takes over too many jobs and we don't figure out what to do about it and we create a depression, do you really think that people won't, like, some of the things they call your company for now, figure out how to do themselves? You know, a lot of the business that a lot of these blue collar companies do, yes, there's the service business, but the industry as a whole, a lot of it is retrofits, new builds. You know, when I was in cabling, you don't think of that as a construction business, but a lot of our jobs were this customer just bought or leased a 15 story building in Dallas and they need to cable all the floors. Do you think cabling was the only need they had? Their plumbing, pipe fitting, electrical work, like the whole shit and shebang. Well, if less of those people go in there, all those blue collar trades, the amount of work available to them goes down too. There's no getting away from this. The question is always going to be, how do I leverage this to stand out among my peers? And if you don't have a plan for that right now, I would work on getting one. And I'll tell you where to start. And it's the focus of my newest book that will be coming out soon. And that is to improve yourself, to become a better you. If you're a better you, you're a better employee, you're a better knife maker, you're a better plumber, whatever you are, to be a better operator within your own niche, no matter what that niche is. So AI may not be helping the knife maker, you know, shape that handle, but it may help him figure out a handle material that gives him a competitive advantage. And it can definitely figure out, how do I leverage the market presence I have now to grow that market presence so that I can continue to do the artisan thing that I like to do? There is no plan B for anybody here. There is no way to avoid this. It's like sitting in 1994 and thinking, well, the internet isn't going to matter to me. And I wish I could tell you that I was always so smart that I was always able to see that, because I wasn't. I remember distinctively walking through malls in the early 90s and having people stand outside a Radio Shack. That's how long ago it was, trying to get me to come over and look at and learn about a cell phone. And I remember all the way back then with my first fiance, who we never actually got married, her saying, well, do you even want to look? I said, no, I already have a pager for work that they made me have. I'll never be able to have peace if I have a phone in my pocket. A year later, I had a phone because they said, you're getting a phone, whether you want one or not, because everybody's getting one. And a few years after that, I realized I couldn't run the portions of the businesses that I run today without one. It would be impossible. And that was before we were doing internet on our phones. I mean, we didn't even have rudiment, like Blackberries. You could access websites, sort of. They look like shit, but you could at least access information. I'm talking like Motorola Razr here, for those that are old enough to know what the hell that is, right? I'm talking about like Nokia flip phones. It is what I'm talking about. But yet, even with that level of tech, I couldn't have run things without it. My first gig running construction work in outside plant construction, we didn't just have cell phones. We had Nextel radio cell phones, right? And they were very useful for that time based on the limits of technology. So even in that sector, the internet, cellular technology, everything completely infiltrated it and did so very, very quickly. And you had to adapt to it. The thing is, now we're dealing with a dynamic, ongoing, upgrading service that's literally an upgrade to the speed and efficiency of humans. And I'm going to tell you this. This is the scary part. Corporations are not prepared to have their humans upgraded. Here's what's even scarier. Upgrading their humans is the only way to fully utilize this technology. That's the impasse they're at. That's why most companies are either just cutting headcount where they can or staring at it, trying to figure out what it is. Because in their guts, they know what it is. It's an upgrade to human performance. And the company has been optimized at each layer in the company to the lowest common denominator. If you've ever wondered, like, why won't they adopt my method of XYZ? And you're kind of entry level, it's because not everybody is capable of your method of XYZ. They have to have a baseline of performance, a floor of performance, that I'm going to hire people into this position, and I will hire people who are this bad This is the minimum qualifications. Like, 'cause there's only so many people to hire. When you're not hiring two people, when you're hiring, 200, you're going to take some you would rather not have. So I have to build the system to accommodate that person's, like, if they're any lower than that, then they get fired. Then they wash out, right? I can't have, or I won't hire them if I identify that. But I can tolerate this. And I'm shooting to get this when I hire, and I'm going to get some that are very close to that floor. And they're designed to run that way. And so if you upgrade the performance of the bottom and the middle and the top haven't adapted yet, you have massive institutional friction. And that's why they're all shitting their pants right now. And so the solution is the problem, right? When it's appropriate culture, you say the problem is the solution. The solution is the problem. The problem is the upgrade of human performance. The solution is the upgrade of human performance. And migrating that over the next 10 years is going to be the most significant, important challenge that organizations are going to have to adapt to. And therefore, if you have a job, you have to do it too. And if you don't have a job, but you have a business, then you own a company. So you have to do it too. So anybody except the person that's completely retired and doesn't give a fuck going forward for the rest of their life, you have to deal with this. You have to deal with this. Okay. And then Blue Maxico 4749. I don't even know what he's talking about because I see amen and absolutely. And then I say, and there's no loyalty. But I agree with the end, there's no loyalty. I don't know if there's out of context for what I'm about to say. But if you thought companies lacked loyalty to their employees before, if you upgrade the human performance floor, then the entry level actually becomes something you can hire lower quality people, and therefore you can pay less. And therefore there's more competition for that kind of mailroom level position. Not actually, but all companies need a metaphorical mailroom. Like if they're sizable, right? If you have 10 people, you can't afford a mailroom, right? And again, it's a metaphorical mailroom. But if you have a company that runs with like even 2,500 employees globally, right? You can't always be hiring experienced people from your competitors. You have to have an entry-level position. You have to have your own pipeline of training and developing your next round of leaders. And so because of that, you are looking for quality to bring in at all times, and you're competing for that quality. But if you can lower that quality expectation, so what becomes a problem in the beginning for the company, shit, these people are too fast now. Once they adapt to it, well, now, how low down the payment scale can we go to bring that entry level position in now? It's going to be freaking crazy. It's going to be freaking absolutely crazy. Top Cone says companies never had loyalty and workers had very little loyalty. I'm not going to say companies never had loyalty. What companies have never had is loyalty beyond Machiavellian reality. I think most owners of most companies really do try to do the best for their employees. But the minute it comes down to, well, if we keep doing this, we'll keep more people for a while, but it's going to hurt the company long term. We got to deal with it now. And that's not necessarily an evil or mean thing to do, because you remember the whole thing of the paraphrase Machiavellian thing is those who are kind when they should be cruel will have to be cruel when they should be kind. And that can be taken and used as justification for a lot of evil shit, but it also is true. There was a time when we were heading into the depression of 2008 that Neil and I took one of our companies and we put the contract recruiters in that company through a very harsh retraining program and a very harsh series of new metrics that they were expected to meet. And it wasn't just sales, like you have to have at least this much in revenue per month. It was, now we're monitoring how many calls you make, what kind of follow-up you're doing. We went into a much more tight management structure for a while until these recruiters became so proficient at it that we were like, okay, we can now back off that. And they didn't like it, and some of them didn't make it. But our point was, if you don't do this now, and nobody believed that recession was coming. you know, this is 2006. We started this process and people were like, why are we doing this? Everything's great. My forecast is good. I'm making my number, whatever. And it's like, but you're not gonna in the next 18 months. You're going to run into a wall. And unless we are over priming the pump now with exploring new business, this is going to collapse and we're going to have to fire all of you. So instead of firing everybody, we washed out a bunch, improved a bunch, and actually grew business during the recession of 08-09 in a technology recruiting company while that sector took a beating because we got ahead of it. That's the mindset it's going to take to navigate stuff with AI. But I want to go with one more story and we'll wrap up for today. Kind of long on a Monday or what have you. But I've been amazed, and maybe it's because I was in school in the 70s and 80s. And I remember like the end, like the very end of the Apollo program. I remember watching shows like Mr. Rogers and the astronaut came on and talked about moon rocks and shit like that. Being a little kid, tell my grandma, I'm going to grow up and be an astronaut. I'll bring you moon rocks that you can make your earrings with and shit like that. And I remember sitting in a Lazy Boy recliner and drinking Tang and thinking I was an astronaut and laying back in it. And I mean, I was like 7 years old, right? So mock that if you want to mock a 7-year-old kid from the 70s, that's fine. And like it being a huge thing and like kids wanted to grow up and be an astronaut. Yeah. And then I remember when the space shuttle program came and it was, we're back in the space race with Russia and every launch was a big deal. Because when people are saying, well, nobody's talking about Artemis because they just went around the moon. We went around the Earth and it was a big deal. Every landing, every time the shuttle came down and landed, it was a big deal. When the Challenger disaster happened, it was truly seen as a disaster. The nation mourned. And in all the good and the bad of this, when I was in school, I'm locking like K through eight. If there's a launch, a landing, anything going on, remember they would wheel a little cart with a TV on it into the classroom and we would watch it. And it was on the news constantly and everybody talked about it. We take this giant rocket that was delayed a lot, over on budgets a lot. People were like, I hope that the delay was due to caution, not incompetence. Like, I hope this works. We put people in it. We shot them into space. They looped around the Earth a couple times, built up momentum, and slingshot it away from the planet. They had to lead the moon like a skeet shooter leading a target with a shotgun on an infinitely more complex level. Right? You don't shoot at the moon. You shoot where the moon is going to be when you get there. They went around the backside of the moon using the moon's gravity to slingshot a capsule back to Earth that eventually used the Earth's own gravity to pull it back to where they want it. They were able to land it in the middle of an ocean exactly where it expected, pick these people up and say, here they are. And everybody went, yeah, so what? I don't care. I've seen almost no discussion about it. I've heard no real buzz about it. I've seen nobody excited about it. And I want to know from you guys, what does it mean? Somebody said earlier, I think it's because we have bigger problems. Like people aren't watching the space program because, you know, they're worried about paying their mortgage. How young are you if you're saying that? Do you remember what the 1970s and early 80s were like? Actually, it was the fact that the country was in such a bad state. Thank you, Jimmy Carter, and thank you, Gerald Ford. The country was in such a bad economic state, and Mr. Nixon as well. I shouldn't leave you out. People wanted to grab onto something that made them feel good about being an American. So if anything, the harshness of the situation should make us be more proud of something. Is it a lack of pride in the country itself? Because I think if you ask most 25-year-olds and people younger, maybe five younger and five older than that in that range, like 20 to 30, I think there's a much lower percentage that are proud to be American than when I was in my 20s. I think if I go back to when I was 25 years old, right? So you're looking at mid-90s. If somebody had walked up to the average person in that 20 to 30. Are you proud to be in? Oh, yeah. I bet it's less than half now. So I think that's part of it. Do we just expect too much? Do we expect things to be too quick? They're going to the moon. Oh, cool. How long is it going to take? 9 days. 9 days? I just ordered bubblegum from Amazon and it was here in 18 hours. Why does it take 9 days to go to the moon and back? They're not landing on it? Oh, screw that. I'll tune in when they, will anybody tune in? I don't mean anybody because that's, I hate the extreme. But will as many people watch the projected moon landing in 2028, if it happens on time like it's supposed to, as watch the Super Bowl? Because let me tell you, the Apollo landings, even the later ones, everybody anywhere was staring at it. What's going on? I think this is a massive extension of what I've called for years microwave mindset or microwave culture, meaning that we have become so accustomed to what technology can do that we're not awed by it anymore. We're not surprised by it anymore. I remember one of Zig Ziglar's talks from way back in the day. He talked about how a little girl got on an airplane. And, you know, this is so far back, they didn't keep the door locked. So you could see into the cockpit. You could see all the controls and out the window and the two pilots sitting in their seat. And then you see through first class and all the way down. And he said, this little girl, so he said, a little cute girl reminded him of like Shirley Temple from back in the day. And she gets on the plane and she looks in the cockpit and she looks down the row and she looks back in the cockpit and she goes, oh gosh. And she was just overwhelmed. Oh my God, look at it. And then he talked about how people that have flown before, it's just getting on a bus. You lose the oh gosh. And one of the keys to staying creative and hungry and developing in your life was not to lose that curiosity and wonder. And for me personally, my moment like that, I remember I was a little kid and my dad dropped me off at my grandmother's diner where she worked. And I was going to go home with her at the end of her shift. So I'm there for like the last half hour of her shift. And she asked me if I want pie. And I said, sure. What do you want? Like apple. She pulls out a little spinny thing. Like this is an old school diner. And she goes, would you like it hot? And I'm a little kid. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I want my pie. That's what I'm thinking. So I'm like, well, how long is it going to take? Right? Like, she goes, not long, a couple seconds. Okay. I'm very skeptical. She goes, I don't even see her put it in the microwave. She goes back, you know, to the back of the thing and comes back in what a couple seconds, like 30 seconds. And she says, be careful. It's hot. Now, I know it's cold in that freaking spinning refrigerator thing that the pie circles around in. I stick my fork and I pull it back. Steam erupts out of it. I'm like, what is this? What, how did you do this? She goes, it's called a microwave. And I was amazed. And like most people, within a couple of years, we had a microwave in the house. You threw shit in it. You hit 30 seconds and you heated shit up and you never thought about it being important again. I think with technology, we do not realize how blessed we are today for all the things that we have. And you know, somebody here is saying only three TV channels in 1968. Yeah, no choice, plus trying to beat up the commies. But see, you're actually making my point. Even in the 80s, it was what, four or five? You had like three channels plus PBS, and then like the predecessor of what we think is Paramount 21 today. Like you had one or two channels you could get on the UHF dial, and you turned your coat hanger antenna a little bit, right? It wasn't just that you didn't have a lot of choice in what you looked at. It wouldn't have mattered. I'm telling you right now, if you had 100 things you could have been staring at in 1982, when that Challenger went up for the first time, I think it was about 82 or 83, you would have watched it. The whole country was enthralled by it because we were doing something amazing. We're putting humans in space. We don't even care we put humans in space anymore. And I think that's bad from a standpoint about what it means for children. I've said this before. I wonder if any child will grow up dreaming about being an astronaut again, if that will be a real dream that kids have when they're 8, 9 years old. Because for every 1,000 kids that have that dream, one makes it. what happens when there's not enough kids to have enough of them make it? And I'm not just talking about being an astronaut here. I'm talking about doing those great things. It's become an expectation someone else will take care of it. The lack of dreaming is why we're not paying attention anymore. And we're not dreaming because we have everything way too easy, and we have lost in our arrogance that sense of curiosity and wonder. And that's why it's one of my, like, I every day think about the things I want to make sure I keep doing in my life, the positive aspects of my life that I want to improve, and the negative ones I want to improve by doing less of them. And one of those things that I'll focus on at least for a few seconds every day is staying curious and maintaining a sense of how can we do this? How, like, asking those questions, pulling at things. And I think it is a very dangerous point for a society when we get to where that's not a normal thing anymore. Especially, it's one thing when old people like us, right? Like us in this generation, right? You get to a certain point, like there's a point, I don't give a shit anymore. Like, I've done mine. And I think that's bad. But for society, it's not that big a deal because you had your time that you were pushing instead of coasting or ending, right? But what happens when most people never have that time because they just take for granted someone else will do it for them? I think that's a very dangerous time, and I think it's a place that we sit right now. But the opportunity is for those that do, you'll move faster than your peers. With that, let's take a few questions, and then we'll wrap up. Okay, let's see. Comment from Darkwing Dave. The street finds its own uses for things. William Gibson, co-founder of cyberpunk genre. Okay. I agree. I don't really know what that comment was in regards to as to what I was saying, because I've been on the air for an hour and a half now. Village 3 question. Do you think Kraken a better option than what Jack Maulers is doing with Strike and Capital 21? I don't think that question flowed very clearly. But what I think you're asking is, do I think Kraken is a better option than Strike and 21 Capital? So 21 Capital is not doing a lot yet. It's not really for you. It's more of an institutional place where you can take your Bitcoin and borrow against it. That's the whole point of that. Strike solves a lot of the problem that the Kraken thing does for the user at my level and your level, because you can send cash. But the problem you have with Strike is still using a third party bank type service so that it can do what it does. So there's still a potential, like, they've done a really great job and I use them and I love them, but there's still a potential choke point there that if more entities are able to adopt the Kraken model of truly being a bank with access to the Fed's network, then they can prevent that. Like, the only way there's a choke point then becomes at the Fed Reserve level. And once you've been let into the fold, it's kind of hard to do that. Like, you've invited the vampire in, now the vampire has access. I don't see how they prevent other players from doing this now, long term. Short term, I think that one of the things I didn't cover there, and this is important to understand, this kind of keys to the club that was given to Kraken is a 1-year trial. And a lot of banks are pissed. And you would think it'd be like the giant mega banks. No, it's like all these little banks and little consortiums of little banks are like, no, you can't do this. And, you know, you can tell the government what they can't do all you want, and they're going to do it anyway. This is analogous to, like, The guy that pays the taxes and the rent and all to run a convenience store in New York City that sells cigarettes for $8 a pack or whatever the fuck it is there now gets really pissed off when some guy out in the street is selling, you know, 2 loose cigarettes for a dollar or something like that, because they're circumventing that whole gilded network that they paid to play in. That's what those banks are pissed off about right now. And there are a lot of black pillars to this thing saying, well, it's not going to do what you think, because the senators and the congressmen are going to pull it back. And Maxine Waters has, you know, filed a complaint about it. Like, when you know that that either side of the political space is phoning it in is when they take their public facing clown and make them the opposition. For the Democrats, that's AOC, it's Liz Warren, it's Maxine Waters. Okay. When one of those people are your candle bearers, and at least Liz Warren is a senator and has actually done a few things in her life that have actually accomplished something, right? So she's like a top grade clown, like your middle clown, because at least she has some clout with people, is AOC. And you're like your bottom of the rack clown for the Democrats in the Congress right now is the Maxine Waters. So when they use, like, okay, you're going to say this so that we can be on board that we oppose this because it's somehow connected to Trump, you're not really trying very hard. It's like, oh, look, we're fighting back. Yeah. So I don't know. I think we're in a different world there as to, is it a better option for you? It depends. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to do? There's like, I think what it's going to do is Kraken's going to get in the same game of Bitcoin back lending, but they're going to be a more one-stop shop. I can't believe Mahler's is going to sit still for this and not work to be able to do the same thing eventually. Ben Yoba says, Jack, Kraken and Coinbase offer loans where you can use Bitcoin as collateral to borrow against it. Currently, the interest rate is 10 to 25%, but I expect it will go much lower in the future. Yeah, Strike already has a much better product than that. The Coinbase product is absolute dog shit. Name it, uses it as a moron. It's a variable rate interest that can change like multiple times a day. So you don't know what you're paying at any given time. The Strike product is a fixed rate, and I don't want to say what it is because I'll probably get it wrong, but it's not two digits. Okay? I will tell you that. I know that. I think it's like 9% or 7.9% or something like that. It is high for a car loan, but lower than a lot of people are paying. And it is a low enough rate that the model, once you have enough Bitcoin to borrow for life, if Bitcoin continues to appreciate at a conservative version of its history over the last 10 years, is forever. So they're already there and they're already way ahead. I'm not going to comment on Kraken's loan rates because I don't know anything about them. What is your selective it coin, Jack, or coins? Bitcoin. That was the one I said you might want to clarify. I don't do shit coins at all. I don't have any select. For a long time, I believed that in the crypto space, there would be some coins other than Bitcoin that would serve a purpose better than Bitcoin could serve that purpose. I no longer believe that. I am a purist. I don't fault you for shit coining. I don't, you know, boycott you for shit coining. I don't think you're a bad person. I just think you're making a very poor financial decision at this point. There can only be one best. And when it comes to money, there is no second best. So that's my advice. Stack Bitcoin and don't worry about it. Question. Satoshi, good, bad. Doge, good, bad. Many coins for short term or long term. I look at 35 most traded. Is there a better pattern? Pretty much the same question. Doge is stupid. It was designed to be a joke. It always was a joke. When Elon Musk talked about it, it was an IQ test that many people failed. Buy Bitcoin. Don't worry about 30 top tokens or whatever. You know what? You want to understand this? The dude asking this question, or anybody that's like, why is he being so hard? Go look up the top 30 crypto projects by market cap in 2018 and go look at the list today and take out Tether and things that are stable coins. Actual, you know, like it's going to do the thing, crypto coins. And then show me any of them that are doing anything that Bitcoin can't do that's actually being done. This one has faster transaction speeds, and this one has lower fees, and this one, yeah, but who's using it to do what? And here's the harsh reality, and this is what made me just decide I'm not touching it anymore. All of these crypto coins and tokens, or whatever the fuck they end up being called, exist only to trade for other crypto tokens. None of them do anything. Remember that if you've been around a while with this, we're going to have a coin for the electric companies, and we're going to have, why? Why do they need, they said, no, there's a $5 trillion market with billing everywhere, and they can load that. Shut up. And none of them did anything. Nobody's using any of them for the thing that they said people would use them for. The only case they have is we're faster, which means you're less secure. And no one cares. Money is what people adopt as money, and people have not adopted any of these shitcoins as money. You know, what's the top competitor to Bitcoin, according to most people? Ethereum. What is Ethereum, really? It is the mother asshole from which most shitcoins are spawned. Okay? And the ones that are spawned from other, you know, coins, like Cosmos or whatever, right? All that is you took the mother asshole of Ethereum and you made an Ethereum analog and made a new asshole to spawn more shitcoins. They don't do anything. Well, people are borrowing against them. They're using them as leverage to buy other shit coins to play in a casino. That's it. They don't provide a function. There's nothing they do that aids business or humanity in any way. They're a gimmick, and you should stop playing with them or don't. It's okay. It's up to you, HFSP. Stanbridge says, do you think Strike greater than 99% safe? Or close to par, hard to beat, 11.5 guarantee. That's what I was talking about, Strike. But it's not the company Strike, for those out there listening that can't see the comment. He put in a ticker symbol, STRC. That is a investment product from Strategy. That's Michael Saylor. And what it is a guaranteed dividend with some risk. So guaranteed, yes. Risk, yes. Basically, you put your money in there, and it spits out 11.5% interest. And that interest can be paid out on a quarterly basis. So it can be a cash flow vehicle. So a person right now with a few million dollars that retires can literally park their money there and have cash flow with no decline in their par value at all. They can earn 11.5% on their money. And there's other products with targets of like 10 and 9% that have lower risk off ratios as well. Do I think it's safe? I think it is safe. Do I think it's so safe that I would put it on there on autopilot and not pay attention to it? No. So it depends on what the word safe means. Do I think it is a reliable investment as buying just about any blue chip dividend producing stock? Yes, and it pays out better. All right, moving on here. Jesse Markowitz. Artemis, hey Jesse, how you doing? Artemis means human civilization is growing up. We are on the edge of becoming a spacefaring race. This gives us a new frontier. That's kind of my point. Instead of looking at this, oh, they went around the moon. No. They didn't just go around the moon. They proved a plan to colonize space is viable. We are going to have people long term. I don't want to say permanent. The location will be permanent, or as permanent as anything humans do. I mean, I'm pretty sure that they thought that, you know, the pyramids in Egypt were permanent from a standpoint of functionality when they built them, right? And now they're a tourist attraction, even though they're still there. So the place will be permanent from a mindset of like a human lifetime. But humans will move in and out. But we'll have that, you know, by 2030, 2032. And it wasn't so long ago that when you said by 2030, it's like, wow, that's way out there. And now it's the time it takes for a baby to go to kindergarten. You know, I mean, it's not that far away. And I think growing up as a species, Jesse's right, that's a great way to look at it. And if somebody's asking me if I've heard of a coin called Dome, no, and I'm not interested. I really don't know how else to say it. Where people will understand when I say no shit coins. It doesn't matter how hard you pitch it. It doesn't matter what you say the use case is. I've been through this. I've been involved in the space since 2012. It's 2026. I've seen all the claims. I've seen all the things that were going to be done all the great use cases, even many that I thought, well, that seems kind of odd, and none, not one made it happen. The only thing shitcoins have ever done is scam people out of their money and be leveraged against other shitcoins. They've never done anything meaningful for society. Nobody's ever built a company on a shitcoin. Michael Saylor's built a company on Bitcoin, right? Nobody's ever turbocharged an existing enterprise like Michael Saylor did with anything other than Bitcoin, and there's a reason. But it's up to you what you want to do. I won't shit on you, but I will shit on the decision you make. I'm sorry. Anyway, guys, real quick here at the end, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Let's give you an item of the day today that is on sale and a really great item, and there's still time to buy them this year and get them put out and extend your gardens if you still want to, especially those of you a little bit further north than me. These are galvanized metal raised garden beds. They are on a deal of the day today. They're made by a company called Free Zone. And if you're looking at the picture and thinking, well, how the hell do they ship something like that to my house? It comes in panels that you screw together in a fairly small box. So it's actually pretty easy to ship. It looks like a stock tank, like a 2 foot wide by 8 foot long oval stock tank, except the bottom's open. That's how these work. You bolt them together, you fill them up, and you plant them. They're on sale for $80. $80. 4 foot by 8 foot by 2 foot deep. You can't build that with pressure treated lumber, and a galvanized version will last for decades compared to even the best quality treated lumber. So it'll last longer, it's easier to put together, and it costs less. That is a buy in my book. So if you've been looking to expand your gardens, now might be the time. And you can find those at tspaz.com. You can find them in the links for today's episode. And you can always find everything at tspaz.com. With that, I'm going to let you guys go. Hope you enjoyed today. And we will be, oh, Lord. Love you, Jack. Go XRP. The shitcoin of shitcoins. The shitcoin of the WEF. The shitcoin that has absolutely no function whatsoever. We're going to work with the banks. Why do the banks need you? They don't. That's the clue. Man, do what you want. HFSP, bro. HFSP. Have fun staying poor. Otherwise, tune in tomorrow. We'll talk about something totally different. You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.